This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
At the end of last month, the United Nations Human Rights Committee delivered a type of report card on Canada. While a letter grade wasn't assigned, the report has been described as scathing and shameful. A few of the 15 matters of concern in the report included allegations of human rights abuses by Canadian mining companies operating abroad, the detention of new immigrants and asylum seekers, and the many forms of discrimination that Aboriginal peoples face. Also alarming were the multiple concerns raised about women's equality and safety. Lara Yeo is on the steering committee for the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action, and she's joined me on the phone this morning from Smithers, BC, to talk a little more about the report. Hello, Lara.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Now, let's start, first of all, with how a report like this comes about.
So the Human Rights Committee is a treaty body of the United Nations, of the Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights at the UN. And there are different treaty bodies that exist that review a state's compliance to a particular treaty. So in this case, it's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So, you know, there's a periodic review period in which a committee will review the state's compliance. And the last time Canada was reviewed was in 2006. And so basically the review process for Canada started in 2005 when the committee released its list of issues. At that point, the Human Rights Committee sort of identified particular issues that it wanted the state to address. The state had at that time already submitted a report on its various compliance to the different provisions of the covenant, and then it responded to the list of issues. And then the actual review occurred in Geneva at Palais Wilson in early July. And then following the review, the formal review meetings, the concluding observations of the committee are released, and those observations were released on July 23rd. And at the end of the observations, you'll see there's actually a paragraph that calls for Canada to report back on particular issues within a year. And so the state is obliged to do so. So there should be a report coming from Canada within a year's time. And then after that, there just is, you know, the following number of years until Canada's next review under this particular covenant. That being said, there are other treaty bodies that are reviewing Canada. So Canada is actually coming up for review in the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 2016, as well as in the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So we do have a couple other human rights reviews coming up fairly soon.
Now, there were three concerns raised around human rights for women in Canada in the report. Let's start with gender inequality. What did they find?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the big issues for us is issues of pay equity and the persistent pay-wage gap between men and women in Canada. And women's median employment incomes are 34% lower than men's. The pay gap on average between men and women is double that of the global average. And we actually rank 27th on the World Economic Forum's global gender gap, so below countries such as the Philippines and Finland. And there really hasn't been any substantive action taken to improve just the pay wage gap in the last few years. There was the Pay Equity Task Force, which released recommendations and ways in which the federal government could take action in 2004. And all we've seen flowing from that really is the Public Service Equitable Compensation Act. And this act, in fact, actually makes it more difficult for women to bring forward pay equity discrimination claims and to seek redress. So in fact, this is an ongoing problem and something that the committee highlighted, which we were really quite thrilled about, because something that is incredibly persistent across Canada and, you know, doesn't seem to be that often brought up in the discussion we talk about, particularly women's or gendered issues.
No, I'm surprised myself, and I imagine quite a lot of people would be surprised unless they were actually working in the area to know that it's still so bad.
Mm-hmm. And especially when considering that women are more likely to work for minimum wage, they're more likely to hold multiple or part-time jobs, so be in more precarious forms of work, more likely to be in sort of the traditional feminized ideas of sectors, so teaching, nursing, services and whatnot. And so these all sort of continue to keep women in, you know, a type of work that are just paid, compensated less, and there aren't active steps taken. So one example that was recently taken in the UK under Prime Minister Cameron was it's an action plan that requires companies to post the wages of its various employees at all the different levels of management. So it's actually what you could consider like a public shaming tactic, but it's part of a task force that's supposed to eliminate pay inequity in the UK by 2020. And this is taken, this was sort of undertaken by a Conservative government. All to say is that pay equity is a nonpartisan issue. It's just about equality, equal pay for equal work. And right now, women are not equally paid. And that is just a reality across the country in all the provinces and territories.
Violence against women also came up. Tell me about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So violence against women is a persistent problem. It's a persistent problem across the world, but absolutely, violence against women occurs in Canada. Domestic violence is of particular concern, especially in northern and rural communities where women have less access to services, less access to shelters. And so there really needs to be an improved response. And one of the main failures of Canada at this point is a lack of a national action plan on violence. And so, you know, the United Nations and other countries across the world have endorsed national action plans to respond to violence, and we don't yet have that. We have piecemeal responses across the country by different provinces and territories. And so the committee really, it spoke out on the low number of cases reported to the police by victims, so the fact that many women still don't come forward with their stories, either out of fear or just, you know, difficulty in access or the cost or the, you know, the potential violence or what this woman could be subject to if those in her community know that she's gone forward. The insufficiency of shelter support services, that's an ongoing issue across the country, particularly in northern and rural areas. And then the failure to effectively investigate, prosecute, convict, and punish. So under international law, there's something called the due diligence standard, which sets out sort of the international standards for police response to violence, so in terms of data collection and ways of persecution, investigation, et cetera. And Canada has been found to consistently violate that standard. Most recently, the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, they released a report in March of 2015, particularly on the issue of violence or murders and disappearances against Indigenous women and girls, as did the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And in both those reports, they talk about the idea of the due diligence standard and the failures of Canadian police agencies to respond adequately to the violence.
Now, that was actually violence against Indigenous women and girls was cited in a different category.
Yes.
In the report. What distinction were they making there?
Right. So in terms of the particular issue of murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls, this is a national crisis, I would say, quite comfortably at this point. It's at a crisis point in which there is this gross violations occurring against these women and girls, and there hasn't been an adequate response. And one of the reasons why it's differentiated is because it really is a different issue, quite frankly. There are particular root causes of violence that make Indigenous women and girls more susceptible to violence and disproportionately more vulnerable to situations of violence, which is why sort of that issue needs to be addressed separately. And it also has been picked up by various committees highlighting the particular need to respond to the sexist and racist violence that Indigenous women and girls suffer just at disproportionately high rates compared to other female demographics across the country. And so the committee talks about the state's reported failure to provide adequate and effective responses to the issue across the territory and culturally sensitive responses to this issue. And they ask for a national inquiry, which has been the common ask across all the UN bodies at this point that have either come to Canada to investigate the issue or that have written reports. Most recently, the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples, James Anaya, when he came to Canada to do an investigation, he then, following his tour in the country, he called on Canada to conduct a national inquiry. The CEDAW recent report in March 2015, as I recently mentioned, they wholeheartedly endorse an inquiry, as does the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
Does the report spell out why it's so important to have a national inquiry?
Yes. So the report does absolutely talk about the particular need for a national inquiry. And that really, it connects to the jurisdictional issues of just the very nature of the federal state of Canada. The idea that we have so many different jurisdictions across country, and there's division of powers between the federal governments, provincial governments, and, you know, municipalities. And at this point, there are differentiated responses that are occurring across the country in different provinces and territories, but there's no coordinated response, and there's no national accountability for ways in which sort of money is being allocated and services are being sort of, you know, created and provided to try and improve the response to the violence. And so one of the biggest calls for the increase stems from the need for a coordinated, comprehensive plan, some sort of real plan that has oversight mechanisms, accountability, transparency, so that people on the ground can really understand how the state is tackling the problem, as opposed to sort of farming out responsibility, if you will. And in terms of the federal-state obligation, this all stems from the fact that Canada holds legal obligations under international law. So it is Canada's responsibility to ensure that there is an adequate response. And right now, what these third-party human rights experts are finding across the country is that there is just an inadequate response. Police agencies are failing to diligently investigate, prosecute, et cetera. And so there needs to be some sort of national coordinated plan moving forward. And the best way to create such a national coordinated plan is to have an inquiry and to really engage in the community level and then create this plan moving forward.
Now, we've been focusing on one part of the report, but what do you think of Canada's overall progress with improving human rights in the country?
So I would say that This review is an incredibly sobering review. It's incredibly sobering because it's the first review, that comprehensive review we've had of the Harper year, so from 2006 to 2015. And what was sort of overwhelmingly clear in the meetings was that things are not well in Canada in regards to human rights compliance. We've actually backtracked an incredible amount, and not only in sort of specific human rights issues such as like violence, pay equity, as we've been speaking about, but just more generally in terms of the silencing of dissent, the crackdown on human rights advocacy, on political advocacy, social environmental justice. We operate in a very different environment now in Canada in regards to human rights work and human rights advocacy. And really, it's curtailing basic freedoms and rights. And there's just continuing chipping away through different acts that overall mean that today in Canada, you know, we're really downsliding. And human rights are quite frankly deteriorating. And it sounds a bit drastic, but this is something that, you know, as a women's rights researcher and student as well in the field, like this is something that I absolutely feel in my day-to-day work, is that human rights compliance in Canada is nothing to be proud of at this time. In fact, we actually really need to we all kind of need to think about whether or not we really want to stick with this, and we do want to stick with this, and then commit to actually really improving our human rights record. Because in terms of domestic implementation, we're not committed anymore, and quite frankly, the governments have been chipping away at basic human rights and freedoms in the last 2 years. And that's, you know, that's spelled out quite clearly in the report in terms of refugee issues and the rights of refugees and irregular migrants, in terms of mining companies and violations that are occurring both in Canada and abroad at the hands of, you know, Canadian mining corporations. It's all quite bad in terms of freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, attacks on unions. I mean, there are many different ways in which you can identify how you know, different legislative measures and policy measures have clawed back basic human rights in Canada.
I guess that's the tremendous value of a report like this, that it will take a big look, whereas we're so close to it all, we just see the little pieces disappearing here and there, and then we don't get the whole picture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think that's one of the great values of this treaty review system and process that we undertake. You know, there are those who critique the United Nations and critique sort of a state's involvement and the fact that there are these third parties who sort of, you know, review the compliance and what right do they have, et cetera, to do this. And I think, the value is that we then have this third party nonpartisan report, which basically looks at ways in which the state has met its international, you know, human rights obligations and standards and ways it hasn't. And that sort of report and overview is incredibly valuable for people on the ground that are engaged in advocacy, that are engaged in policy, that are engaged in government, and just general civil society to have a sense of, you know, where we stand, quite frankly, in regards to other states' compliance with basic rights. And we're talking about civil and political rights. These are cornerstone rights in, you know, the international human rights legal system. And while, you know, there's indivisibility of human rights, and what that means is that, you know, civil and political rights stand on sort of the same plane as economic, social, and cultural rights, and you can't really have one without the other, quite frankly. But traditionally, civil and political rights were the entrenched rights, and this report very clearly illustrates ways in which Canada is attacking those rights, quite frankly. And this is something that we absolutely shouldn't stand for. So this report really is a wake-up call. It's a report that I recommend that any Canadian who's interested in where we stand right now in regards to civil political rights compliance, that one reads and really takes quite seriously, because these are independent third-party experts, you know, seriously looking at Canada's record, and this is what they've decided. And what they decide, quite frankly, is hard to take. We have a lot of work to do at home.
What kind of weight does the report have?
So that's a very good question. So part of, you know, in this sort of international human rights system is that there isn't an enforcement mechanism, right? And that's, so there aren't international police, if you will. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights is non-binding, as are the other covenants. But that being said, once you ratify, you are legally obliged to abide by these standards. However, then there is the optional protocol to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And once you are part of that procedure, as sort of acting alongside the norms of international law, you are obliged to abide by the standards and to act in good faith to work towards implementing these rights domestically. And so in regards to the binding nature, if Canada doesn't, for example, heed a recommendation, that there is going to be like no tangible consequence necessarily, like UN police aren't going to show up on Canada's doorfront. That being said, it's made known through these reports. It's observed, you know, internationally, other countries like follow different states' rights records, and quite frankly, Canada has served as an example in past times to other states and a country that takes its international human rights obligations very seriously and works to actually, you know, incorporate the recommendations of various treaty body committees. And this is no longer the case. We're no longer seen as, you know, a beacon of human rights in Canada anymore, and we're not necessarily considered to be a state that takes committee recommendations particularly seriously. For example, one relatively contentious issue that came up in the review in July were interim measures. And this is when the committee takes on individual complaints, because individual Canadians can actually go to the Human Rights Committee with a complaint against the state and allege that Canada is violating, you know, a particular article of the covenant. And that, you know, these violations are something that is felt by this particular individual. And if the committee picks up that complaint, they will then consider the complaint and they'll write a decision. And in the decision, there are interim measures, what they ask the state to do. And Canada in recent years has ignored these interim measures. And that is a basic act of bad faith, quite frankly, in the international human rights system. After the committee has found the state to be, like, in violation of an article, for the state to then say, okay, well, we understand your position, we're not going to do anything about it. I mean, that really is just complete disregard for the system. And that's what's been happening, quite frankly. And it happened again in July when the issue of interim measures came up again, and the government representative basically said, yes, we respect your opinion, we take your opinion very seriously, but we choose not to act on it at this time. And that is very disheartening if you're someone who really believes in the system and believes in Canada's sort of obligation to respond and to act in a way that's compliant with basic human rights standards. Like, that's not the government response you want. However, that's the government response we currently have in Canada. So
it's been really great talking to you this morning, Laura, and I think a real call to action.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, my pleasure. Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate speaking with you. It's been great.
I've been speaking with Laura Yeo. She's on the steering committee for the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action.